I would also on that be able to quote the golden speech and Elizabeth's response. I think that black question is absolutely lovely. Final thing to say about that black question is you would lead, of course, with religion, because it's the underpinning factor. Now that brings us to the red question. How far do you agree that parliamentary privilege was the most important cause of disputes between Elizabeth and her parliaments? Well, the first thing to say to you is, the difference between this and the black question is, this question, the red question here, has got a named factor. Now, that means you've probably got to lead with parliamentary privilege, which is a strange one because there's less to say about that than religion or the religion in the 1559 Parliament or marriage in the 1566 Parliament or even monopolies in the 1601 Parliament. You must know that Wentworth quotation. Yeah? The obvious point, ladies and gentlemen, is why does Peter Wentworth want free speech? He wants it to allow him to challenge the monarch on matters of state. And that means religion and associated issues to religion, such as marriage and succession. It is basically the same essay. But you lead with parliamentary privileges, you then pull in religion and marriage and succession and say none of these three are actually serious conflict. The best conflict focuses on monopolies, and that is not linked to the issue of religion at all. With this question here, the tie back must be clearer. As you consider these different factors at the end of each paragraph, you must be comparing its weight to parliamentary privileges. It's hard to do that essay without that quotation on free speech. A couple of years ago, I took an upper sixth up to some lectures in London, and John Guy was there, and I asked him, are there any other aspects of parliamentary privilege other than freedom of arrest, which doesn't really come up in the Tudor times, that's very much a Stuart issue, and Wentworth and free speech? And he said, no. So you must have Wentworth secure. You must be clear also about Strickland. Okay, that brings us to the blue one. How far is it correct to suggest that Elizabeth effectively controlled Parliament in her reign? You might also get this as Elizabeth and her ministers. And that's actually what we're going to look at in a minute. So, it is the same essay. If Elizabeth effectively controlled Parliament, then it did not challenge her on religion, free speech, succession, finance and monopolies. With each of these, however you're going to argue, you always want to lead with the conflict and then judge with the cooperation argument, don't you? Because the other way around doesn't make any sense. Why am I saying that? Because the cooperation argument is a reaction to the conflict argument which comes first. Happy? How far is it correct to suggest that Elizabeth effectively controlled Parliament in her reign? Well, you could pull this apart a bit more, actually, and suggest, look, there is a Puritan choir, but it doesn't get its way on religion. Elizabeth is, what is it, Susan Duran says of Elizabeth, Orthodox and conventionally pious Protestant, something like that, isn't it? Yeah? It's in your notes. You could say she doesn't have to control Wentworth because it's actually the House of Commons that sends him away. The obvious point here is even if you're arguing for opposition, they don't change Elizabeth's religious settlement, they don't get free speech, they don't get her to name a successor or indeed who she's going to marry. Moreover, you want to have those dates on subsidies. You know that table I gave you which says when there's all the multiple subsidies? That's a really good way to use evidence of pace. And you can overwhelm an examiner with that because they just won't see that density of contemporary analysis. Okay? So we move to the gold one here. How convincing is the claim that Parliament became more powerful in the reign of Elizabeth? Well, look what I've written underneath. It's the same factors. You would need to set out in your introduction, if Parliament became more powerful in the reign of Elizabeth, then John Neill is correct to suggest that there was an opposition group in a significantly new sense, one with an independent and positive programme. He called this a Puritan choir. If it does not become more powerful, then Graves and Elton are correct to dismiss this. This can only be answered by considering the interlinked issues of religion, parliamentary privileges, marriage, Mary and succession, finance and monopolies. Can you see what we've done with these four questions? This is the thing you need to write down, guys. This is the thing you need to get in your head. Your introduction is tying the question to the historiographical debate. Let me say that to you again to stress it. You've got four different questions here, and the fifth is just the same, it's just nastily worded. You've got four different questions here, and each of them is asking you to tie the historiographical debate to the question and then answer it using the same factors. Can you see now why it's actually not that scary a topic at all? I want to turn to the green question, which was a rogue question, really. And it said, to what extent did the House of Commons become more important compared to the House of Lords? Nobody did this. And remember, you've always got a choice. But it is really the same matter. If conflict in the House of Lords is the dominant theme, then if conflict in the House of Commons is the dominant theme of Elizabeth's 14 parliaments, 14 sessions of parliaments, I should say, then the statement is correct. However, if the House of Commons is cooperating, then the House of Lords retains its superior status. I think that question there, this used to be a whole unit separate on its own, is a product of examiners sitting down saying, well, how can we ask the same question in a different way? They only ever asked it once. Can you see, ladies and gentlemen, before we move on to look at an exam report, that whether you're doing the black, red, blue, yellow, or even green question, you're doing the same thing. You are tying the historiographical debate to the question in the introduction and answering it through the factors. You need to have, this is worth writing down, you need to have two or three lines of attack for each theme, for cooperation and conflict. That's why I designed those booklets with the seesaws, where you had to pick out the main arguments. That's really all I want to say from this overview slide. Should we have a look at the marker guidance and exam report then, please? So we're on to slide 2 now, and this is a June 2009, obviously old spec question. How successful was Elizabeth I and her ministers in managing Parliament? I wonder whether any of you would have done the really clever thing here. I'd like to think with a bit of revision, you could turn it into one of these. But the really good student, the really, really good student, would be able to pull apart Elizabeth I and her ministers. Think, for example, here's two things to write down. Think, for example, about the 1601 monopolies crisis, where Robert Cecil is effectively heckled out of the House of Commons. They list all the monopolies that have been given out. He famously says the behaviour is more fit for a grammar school. And he has to go and see Elizabeth. By this time, 68, bald, toothless, crooked on the back. And she has to go and put her wig on and saunter down to Parliament. And where Robert Cecil fails utterly, she gives the golden speech and they give her quadruple subsidy. The obvious point about the monopolies crisis, and I've held back for here, for this, is simply this. This is the only time Elizabeth is forced to back down on a matter of state. But, of course, crucially, it is not one that is directly linked to the Puritan choir argument of John Neill. I want to say something about the examiner report and the trap there in a second, but can I just very quickly say something about the Puritan choir as we're here? The Puritan choir pamphlet, that is really the foundation of the Neill argument, is a document that he found in for the 1562 Parliament. Today, revisionists and post-revisionists would say that it's a satire. Excuse my language, it's a piss take. Okay? There's names signed on there that are government ministers. Yeah? It's a kind of 1562 version of a Private Eye magazine. Yeah? Where everybody's, you can almost imagine it like naughty school kids, it being signed and passed on, and some people signing other people's names. For that to be the foundation of a thesis is thin. Can I guide you on this overview here to the examiner report, and in particular to the trap that they highlight in the first paragraph? Let me read you this. At the lower end, candidates tended to describe methods Elizabeth used to manage Parliament, or became embroiled in a description of the historiography. Well, you could see that happening, couldn't you? I know all this clever stuff, so it's going in, when what they really want on these mark schemes is a factor-based essay. Okay? This frequently resulted in detailed descriptions of Neill and the Puritan choir. You could imagine that kid walking out thinking, I've written lots of really clever stuff. And then they get their low grade and they're bemused. And it's because they haven't answered the question. I'm sorry to say it to you again, but you must produce a factor-based answer to a question asking about the nature of the relationship between, should we say, the centre, whether it was Elizabeth, or Elizabeth and her ministers, or Elizabeth and the council, and Parliament. Look at the second paragraph there. At the top